Hello, everybody. Welcome to the 23rd Alexis L podcast. It's just me and Talal today. Mostly, I will be answering your questions that you've sent to me via WhatsApp and Instagram and so on and so forth. Just also give you a quick update on what I've been doing. I think I've slightly let the podcasting and the bike riding slide. The reason is that I have been working on my new series for Radio 4, which is called Alexis Sales Strangers on a Train. We did the pilot late last year, which you may have heard went out late at night on Radio 4. And Radio 4 loved it so much that they commissioned a series. So there's going to be 7 of them. And it's going to go out after the Archers on a Sunday night, which is quite a prime slot. So what it basically involves me doing is I usually catch a train for no reason. And then I meet up with another train and I get on that train. Like, for instance, I traveled from London to Manchester. And then from Manchester, I caught a train that went from Manchester to Bournemouth. And while I'm on the train, I just talk to people on the train, really. I recount things that have happened to me in the various towns that we go through. In fact, the Manchester to Bournemouth episode is quite heavy on that. I think it's really interesting. Really interesting piece of radio. I think at its best, it's phenomenally deep. You can kind of get drawn into, I know what's happening, but I think it's kind of slow radio in a sense. I just let people talk about asking where they're going, and you get some fascinating stories. And I think if it works, it's going to make really interesting radio and really different in a way. We don't get the show never gets off the train. It's entirely recorded on the journey. I don't plan in any way. I don't plan what I'm going to ask. I don't plan. I say the things that, you know, I talk about anecdotes that have happened to me. I haven't written them down or anything. They're very spontaneous, and that gives them a kind of, a different kind of quality, I think, because most television and radio and stuff, by its nature, is pre-planned. So yeah, it's a really interesting. It's tremendously exhausting. One of the things going from Manchester to Bournemouth or Cardiff to Portsmouth or London to Glasgow for no reason is extraordinarily exhausting experience, really. Nevertheless, this will be coming to your radios in June. You know, if you want to meet me, then just, you might just get on a train at random. I might be on it. So that's basically, what I've been doing.
Yeah, you've been really busy with that. Whenever I'm calling you to schedule something, you're like, Shropshire.
yeah. And we stay at Premier Inns, which I must say I've really taken to.
You have?
I really enjoy the Time. Well, their basic restaurant is called Time, THYME.
Yeah.
But the one in Portsmouth that we stayed in was called The Block.
Ooh.
And was like a steakhouse. I don't know whether it's just I'm kind of delirious after spending all day on a train talking to people, but I value my 2-3 glasses of wine and my...
It's a rare occasion that Premier Inn is getting compliments by a comedian. That's normally like...
Yeah, moan about them?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it's kind of... It's on the lower tier of accommodation.
Really? I think they're fine. I don't know why you'd want to stay. I don't know why you'd want to stay anywhere else, really.
It's a shortcut gag, too, because...
Yeah, they're fine, I think. I mean, and I've talked, I don't know if I've talked on the radio, but I mean, that was one of the things. Well, touring in the 80s and 90s was nightmarish because hotels were so bad.
Oh, I was going to ask, what's the worst place you've ever stayed?
Oh, fuck. There was a place in, we did the tour of the comic strip in 1982. And we stayed in a place called the County Hotel in Sheffield. It was so cold that I had to sleep. It was a horrible hotel. We had to sleep. I mean, I think Peter Richardson had a predilection for kind of hotels with character. So I think we would stay in a terrible kind of nightmarish place, even if there was a better place available. But I had to sleep with my hat on. And also our regular keyboard player, Rod Melvin, I think couldn't make it that day. So we had a substitute. My memory of him is that he was a driving instructor by day who smoked a pipe, but he picked up the waitress. He was like really sleazy, but he picked up the waitress in the pizza place where we ate, and I could hear him having sex with her in the room next door. So that's
why did he need to sleep with your hat on?
Because it was so cold. It was freezing. Tour, we stayed in universally terrible hotels there. As I say, I think Peter did it deliberately, really. Just awful.
How big is the crew you have with you when you're making strangers on a train?
It's an interesting, thank you for that. Well, we've got, there's me, there's a sound recordist, Lyndon. There's a young researcher called Harriet who's got charming personality, and she's the one who goes and kind of goes through the train asking for people to come and see me. Uh-huh. And then there's the other producer, Peter, who's a guy about the same age as me, and he basically just kind of oversees the thing. So it's four of us.
So you're sat in one spot and they bring the people to you?
Yeah.
You have your own carriage, so that is
nice. No, but the train company, I have to say again, I'm going all corporate now. I have to say a big thank you to Cross Country Trains, who've been tremendously cooperative on the majority of trips we've done, because we want journeys partly that go from one odd place to another. So Cross Country Trains tend to undertake that journey, but they've been tremendously helpful. What they have done usually is secured me a four-seater in first class, nice. A table and four chairs, and the sound recorders, and puts the microphones in the center of the table, and then I sit on one side.
Usually, like you're doing a podcast.
The people. Then Harriet goes through the train and gets people, and they come to see me, and they sit opposite me.
And then who is the fourth person?
The sound recordist, you, sound Harriet,
researcher,
producer, and me.
There's four of you. Yeah, okay, because I was picturing you walking up and down the train and, like, you know, tapping people on the shoulder.
Yeah, by myself. Yeah. You could do that. I mean, it would theoretically be possible, but I think, I mean, the one bit of it, I think I'm a very good interviewer because I just let people talk and I've got no agenda, really, and I'm genuinely... I mean, I've met some amazing... I mean, particularly really interesting women who do fantastic things.
Oh, just fucking imagine if it was James Corden or Michael McIntyre, and they would just be crowbarring in their own shit.
Like, exactly. I'm just fascinated by people, and I just let them talk, really. And in fact, we had a cut. I mean, yes, you can't imagine James Corden or Michael McIntyre. The first cut of, I listened to a first cut of Manchester to Bournemouth, and I just thought it was too much of me. And I just said, you know, to Peter, who does the edit, really, just take me out, because it's just, you know, it's not about, I mean, it's kind of about me, and it's about my experience, my connection with the journey, but it's also primarily about the other passengers on the train, and that's,
You're a fucking brilliant performer and producer of content, because you care about the finished product. It's not about putting yourself at the front.
And I know, it's all, I know. And it's kind of unique that, I mean, it's not really a great claim, but I mean, it is that I am, as an interviewer, I want to let the interviewee talk, and that's almost unheard of in
A lesser comic would use it as an advertisement for their ego, you know.
Yeah, that's but amazing. I'm just interested. I'm fascinated by people, like, well, you know, what they had for their tea. I mean, genuinely, this is not an affectation. I just want to know about people. Really,
as a producer myself, I'm blown away by the simplicity. I would not have fucking thought of that. Have you in one spot and go and research the passengers and bring them over to you?
Yeah.
That little touch, I can just see how that would make the show so much better.
Yeah, really weird.
Than have you going up and down the train exhausted. It's such a simple touch.
Yeah, yeah. It was the producers, Peter and Nick, who decided on that format right from the start. And Harriet, you know, she's a student at Cardiff University, I think, doing a kind of media, but she's very sweet natured and stuff. And she just, you know, she just, you know, she's very good at bringing people, you know, just persuading people to come and talk, really. So, you know, it's a and the sound recorder is obviously, you know, tremendously experienced.
I used to have to do that for the BBC. I was a researcher on a bunch of reality shows. And you have to, you know, chase people with release forms and stuff. And
yeah. I mean, I think it's an unusual, I mean, it's a particularly unique task, which I think she does it very well.
Yeah.
It's, you know.
You got to have a good personality to do that.
Yeah. And that's the one area that I couldn't, you know,
I worked on 24 Hours in A&E. Have you seen that show?
Yeah.
That was a difficult one to do it for.
Yeah, imagine. I mean, there's so many shows like that now. That was the original, was it? I think, or one of the first. But they just put like remote cameras everywhere in the hospital,
and they filmed everyone first and then asked for permission. So that was a really tricky thing to do, because they're like, but there are signs all over the hospital saying you're being filmed. There are cameras here.
Yeah,
you know, it's like, if you don't want emergency treatment here, go somewhere
else. Get sick.
Go somewhere else.
Yeah, take your broken leg elsewhere.
Limping to the next door hospital.
Yeah, I mean, that seems a bit exploitative. I mean, it was rough,
and that made me actually quit telly, that job.
Really?
Yeah, after really actually quite a harrowing kind of story they were following.
Right.
It was really rough, and I was like, I can't do this. But I did appreciate how the finished product was really good, and also kind of important in showing the hard work of the NHS and stuff.
Yeah, kind of. But then you do think, hang on a minute, as well. Yeah, it's, you know, you see the finished project and you kind of accept it. But yeah, the, like you say, the kind of coercion and the sort of intrusiveness of the processes, in a sense, it's very morally ambiguous, I think. Yeah.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine, like, having a stroke, you know, heaven forfend, and then, you know, finding out a couple days later, and the kind of things you say and do while you're having a stroke, and the doctor
you
and stuff, and then a couple days later...
Don't you get a permission form right then, there and then? Well, you can't...
Not in those
character.
Kind of situations.
No.
Like those, they just kind of film it and hope for the best, and hope that when you're...
But then you have to chase up the... You chase up the...
The
victim afterwards and get them to sign a permission form.
And they're like, they didn't know when they were in an ambulance that that hospital was being filmed.
Yeah.
And
it's very, I'd say it's, rough, you know, it seems entirely neutral. And like you say, you know, celebrating the NHS. But when you think about how those shows are put together, there is a very kind of, it's a thin ethical line that they cross over, I think. Yeah.
And
yeah, I agree.
So yeah, that kind of was the limit for me.
Yeah, really.
Because the director was very gleeful in the what they were capturing. And we're like, we're watching like real life, like suffering, and it's happening right now.
Yeah.
And you're smiling and going, get a close up, zoom in on her face. Oh yeah, that's great. And I was like, oh, this is... It was like psychopathic behavior. I couldn't.
Yeah.
Be there anymore.
Yeah, there's a famous from the 1930s. There's a cartoonist called Bateman. I can't remember which paper he worked for, but it's something like the cartoon. It's like this man jumping up and down with glee, and it's only, you know, the editor of a newspaper hearing about a hideous murder in Limehouse or something. Oh. You know, and he's, I just thought, that's sums it all up, really.
I'll tell you one thing, and then I have a question about it for you. But like that, what I was also a runner on that show, and I'd have to make the tees for like the sound mixer and the camera operators and stuff. And one of their tee requests was he liked a mint tee, but he wanted it cold, so I had to make it an hour in advance,
right?
And with milk, so it was a cold mint tee with milk. So I had to like prepare his tee order an hour in advance.
Right.
Did you ever, have you ever made strange requests from runners on shows you've worked on? And what's the most you've asked of a runner? Have you ever felt bad for something you've asked?
I think there must be things in my past where I have asked for terrible things. When I toured Australia, I had a particularly successful tour of Australia, I think in 1990, and I thought for some reason that I was going to go for bike rides around the various towns in Australia I was in, and I made the poor publicist kind of find me a bike, and she had to kind of carry it from town to town until I told her to. You know, I was never going to ride it, and she just threw it on a rubbish tip, I think. You know, they shield you from, you know, you're not, I didn't see her. She hid her suffering from me with she was schlepping this fucking bike around from town to town. She's a very nice girl. So we're very fond of her. But, you know, they hid their suffering from me, really. Yeah. I think
that's pretty bad.
It was terrible, really, yeah. And also, I think because of that, I was drunk on power, because that tour, it's the only tour where we put in like loads of extra dates that I've done, and it was a massive success. And I was on like the Australian news, and like, you know, me arriving in Australia like the Beatles, and it was like a massive hit. And funnily enough, the next tour that I did was not nearly as successful. But it was the one time where I've really had a runaway. You know, we put it 5, 10, and loads of extra nights in Sydney.
Nice.
And the other thing that I also said to the promoters, I wanted them to buy me. There was a little Suzuki used to make a pickup entirely for the Asian market.
Ooh.
Tiny little pickup based on a little hatchback called the Suzuki. It was called the Suzuki Mighty Boy. And they used to do a Mighty Girl as well in pink. And I got so drunk on power that I remember seeing one at Sydney Airport. It was like a little two-seater. I just loved it. And I asked the promoters to buy me and ship me to England as a kind of present end of a Suzuki Mighty Boy. And, you know.
It's a bit more than a bike.
I think they went, yeah. Well, they made a phenomenal amount of money. But, I mean, it was...
Did they get it for you?
Nah, they kind of made, you know, they kind of pretended to be looking for one until, you know, my enthusiasm died down. I'm sure they were used to. They'd done like Frank Sinatra and stuff in their time. They were used to kind of stupidities of entertainers.
I'd love a pickup.
Yeah, it was really cute. Suzuki Mighty Boy, Suzuki Mighty Girl. They were made in Thailand, but there was mostly for, they were... right-hand drive, you know, because they were mostly sold in Australia and other countries that drove on the left. So, there's probably somebody out there who's a fan of the Mighty Boy
or
Mighty Girl.
Did you play the Sydney Opera House?
I didn't play the – I used to play the State Theatre in Sydney. Generally, I have played the Sydney Opera House. That was when I was there in 2016, yeah.
Wow.
It was amazing, man. It was sold out, really. And it was part of the Sydney Writers Festival, it was an amazing experience. It was really. I think I'd been in Melbourne, and I was by myself, which is unusual because Linda didn't come on that trip. And so I flew from Melbourne, I think, in the morning, went straight more or less to the Opera House, met some friends, and had lunch, you know, overlooking Sydney Harbour.
Mm.
And then did the gig, you know, and it's low risk because it's a kind of book reading. But the predictably the acoustics and so on were, I don't know how many it holds. It's like 3,000 or something. It was just a phenomenal gig. It was really amazing.
That's cool.
Yeah. But I know it's an interesting question, ridiculous requests I've made of runners and stuff. Because I think I would not be a runner's favorite. I mean, I would not be like really one of the ones who's hated, you know.
Yeah.
But I would not. I don't think a runner would really find me.
You might come across as a bit cold because you're actually quite shy and you're quite quiet when you're not on, when you're not working. So runners might be a bit perturbed by that, I think. But I can't imagine you being. Maybe when you were at your peak and your ego.
I was a worse. Yeah, yeah. I could be a bit. Yeah, and probably the mate, again, if you're a runner and you're listening to this. Continuity. I remember having a drink. I was working on a kind of TV movie and the continuity girl screaming at me in the bar of the hotel afterwards, but because I was fucking about with what hand I was holding my pencil in, you know, I didn't respect.
Oh.
That's being a.
She screamed at you for that.
She was really shouting at me, yeah, about what a fucking nightmare I was.
Oh, wow, naughty, naughty Alexi. Mighty boy.
Suzuki Mighty Boy.
That's
yeah.
That's the name of the episode. I'm titling the episode Mighty Boy. Yeah. That's really good. Just the word alone.
Yeah.
Give me the giggles. Yeah. Okay, yeah. We have lots of questions to catch up on. So, yeah, we've had a really nice run of some great guests and journalistic episodes and stuff, but it's been a while since we've caught up with emails. So,
yeah.
I thought I'd throw some at you.
Absolutely. Hit me.
Thought we'd start with some quick fire ones, so don't feel, unless something comes to you, don't feel the need to dwell on any of these. I put out a story on our Instagram, which is Alexi Sale Pod on Instagram, if anyone wants to follow us there, and I asked our followers for questions for Alexi, we talked about all-time favorite car. Have you mentioned that on the show before?
No, people have asked me about that.
Would you like
to? The Suzuki Mighty Boy probably is one of mine. I'd forgotten about that. So I never actually owned one, but having been a motoring journalist, people often asked me, what's your favorite car? And I never really, I think this is aesthetic, there's all kinds of things wrong with it, but I think the most beautiful car in the world is a short wheelbase Land Rover from about the mid-90s. Land Rover 90, either diesel or V8. I just think there's something that may... I mean, I owned one. They're a nightmare to drive. They do about, used. I'd have won a V8, 3.5 litre, used ludicrous amounts of fuel. And it broke down. It used to break down when it rained. It wouldn't start when it rained.
Isn't that the whole point of a Land Rover?
I know. It was. There was extraordinary. There was like a crack in the where the spark plugs were, I think. And it just, when water got in, it wouldn't start. I remember it was a lot of the rivets that were rusting, and there was like, you had like about, it was like, you were like a kind of a jailer in a Victorian prison. There's so many different keys to just, to operate, like the fuel cap, the back door, the ignition. There's a whole bunch of keys that you needed. It was ludicrous. You'd always bang your right elbow on the kind of door. I mean, it was an amazingly heavy clutch and
but yeah, it's your favourite.
But it was just, I think it's the most pleasingly, it's what they call, it's a two box design, which is a classic saloon is a three box design. So you got the engine, which is a box, you got the passenger compartment, which is a larger box, and you got the boot trunk, which is a third box. So this is a two box design, so large passenger compartment, and engine. And it's just something extraordinarily harmonious about that design. So I'd say that would be my choice of most beautiful car ever.
Okay.
I was persuaded to buy one. This is a story I tell by a young actor called Dexter Fletcher, who he's gone on. He was a kind of child actor, and he was in a movie that I'd written. And he's gone on. He's sort of specialized in he directed, I think uncredited, he directed the Queen movie. And then he also directed the Elton John movie, both of which in a sense are terrible.
They came out in like the same year, didn't they, as well? Within a year?
Kind of, yeah, yeah, yeah. He's developed these hagiographical portrayals of dissolute rock stars seems to be a kind of niche that he's fallen into. He's a good actor. He was in like, not Saving Private Ryan, the other one. He was in Band of Brothers, I think. And his brother was also an actor. But it was because of him that I ended up myself with a short wheelbase Land Rover V8 Defender. He had one when we were, he was very young, but for some reason he had one. And I persuaded him to let me, he wasn't happy with it, but I persuaded him to let me take it for a drive. And I thought, I'm going to get one of these. So I did.
Oh, him.
Yeah. Really interesting career.
Yeah, he used to host Games Master when I was a
kid.
That's
right, yeah.
I used to watch that show all the time. Okay, interesting.
I think he might live around this. I think I've seen him in the street with a dog.
It was a nostalgic experience seeing his face again. I just Googled him.
Yeah. And it's a, you know, it's a, I shouldn't, it's a skill direct, you know, being a director is hard, really, and, you know, to help. And I think they've both been really successful, those movies. I mean, I particularly fucking hated the Queen one, but I mean, and I'm a big fan of Rami Malek as well. I love Rami. I mean, he was in, it's going down rabbit hole, isn't it? But he was in he was one of the cast of the War in the Pacific version of Band of Brothers. Playing somebody from New Orleans, I think, and you thought, bloody hell, who's that guy? Especially because he's Egyptian. And Mr. Robot, which, you know, is good in parts and stuff. So I'm a big fan of Rami Malek, but...
it was called The Pacific.
His portrayal of Freddie Mercury, yikes.
Well, I thought he was the best thing about that film.
Yeah, no, it was kind of good in a cartoon kind of way, but I just...
Yeah, it was very over the top. And lots of shorthand storytelling.
And it's just very untruthful, I think. Yeah.
Did you ever meet Queen or have any experiences meeting Queen?
I feel like I've met Brian May.
Yeah.
Somewhere, but I can't remember where. But he's very good about animals. I'll give him that.
Hmm.
But I can't remember.
Okay. You never went to one of Freddie Mercury's parties or something?
No. No.
Okay. Yeah, done cocaine off of Chippendale's chest.
No. Sadly, no. I wish I had.
Are you still a Maoist?
No, not really. I mean, I was a... Just to brief recap, my parents were in the British Communist Party. You have to know the kind of the minutiae of disagreements amongst the left, really. But my parents were in the British Communist Party, and my act of rebellion was to move briefly when I was about 16 to move further to the left of them and become a supporter of China, which is, and therefore a Maoist. And the China pretended to be kind of the authentic voice of Marxist-Leninist thought, you know, whereas Russia had become reformist, revisionist, they called it, by because they let, like, people have a choice of two different types of pen. and so, I you know, I'm still, I mean, but my, and then I was in this Maoist party called the Communist Party of Britain, Marxist-Leninist, and it was very, you know, it was during my, I mean, I left when I was about 21. I ceased to be a member of any party, but it was a tremendously. I wouldn't. I think that, you know, both China and the Soviet Union were terrible, terrible places, which betrayed, you know, betrayed socialism, betrayed, you know, treated their people. So, you know, there were reasons for it in a way, but I think that that whole idea of Marxism, Leninism, the cadre of what's called democratic centralism and stuff just leads to dictatorship and cruelty on an enormous scale, you know. And I think it's a kind of interesting, I think that, I mean, awful things happened under Mao, really. And,
it's really sad. These, like, you know, beautiful ideas.
Yeah, and it's also, as you say, exactly. Your people, you know, people's impulse to make a better world and then somehow... I mean, that's why, you know, I think what we've talked about a bit is that right-wingers are horrible, horrible people. They're just vile people. Left-wingers are, you know, by and large, nice people, but they still, in the way, it still seems like, you know, certainly Marxism, Leninism has always led to terrible, terrible things, really, and it's problematic, you know.
The cliche is power corrupts, you know.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, it's a cliche because it's true.
Could you imagine Corbyn, if he managed to become prime minister, becoming a tyrant?
Fast forward 20 years. But he would have been, I don't know what would have, you know, in the unlikely event.
He's doing great stuff on the, you know, his experience with us, by the way, has inspired him to go and start doing similar things.
Oh, really?
There's not much I can say because, you know, I don't want to blow up his spot, as they say.
No.
But if you, what he's doing, what's currently coming out from Corbyn is really interesting on his TikTok. Jeremy Corbyn has a TikTok and he has videos. He's doing like man on the street interviews now.
Okay.
He's on the street in his constituency with a microphone talking to locals.
Right.
Asking them about the community center and the food bank, and then he does a little piece to camera at the end. So just, I would love to plug Jeremy Corbyn's TikTok.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Always, you know, always close friend of the show.
He's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I should say, I don't know, it's really because I've also been, the other thing I've been working on is that there's a new series of Sandwich Bar, I think, which is, Lexi Sells Imaginary Sandwich Bar, which is scheduled for the end. The recordings, if people want to, I mean, they won't be on, they're not exactly on sale, but, you know, we will be recording at the Radio Theatre, I think, three Fridays, I think, in late September, and I know they're always massively oversubscribed, because the free tickets for those shows. But so I've also been kind of just last few couple of months really mapping out what those shows are, because in contrast to Strangers on the Train, which is completely unplanned, and I think that that's a deliberate. The reason that Sandwich Bar is, you know, some people say the best radio show that there's ever been.
Yeah.
Which I think is a reasonable...
That's what the smart people say.
Yeah, it's because it's meticulously... You know, everything is written, meticulously written, planned out. I work it all live, usually at the Museum of Comedy and stuff. You know, I try to test out... Most of the material has been tried in front of an audience before it's done on the radio and stuff, you know, which is... Very unusual, I think, you know, but it's a phenomenal amount of work goes into those shows. And that will be presumably be TX transmitting towards the end of this year. And at the moment, a lot of the stuff is about my thoughts, because it's based, you know, there's elements of it's based on the 2020 stand-up tour is about, you know, Corbyn and that whole situation, really. It'd be interesting to see, one, how I make it fit now, and two, whether... the BBC has always been, Radio 4 have always been phenomenally supportive of me, and I don't know, it'll be interesting to see whether that will continue, really, you know.
Well, you do work very hard on it. You're doing your test shows now.
Yeah, yeah. So anybody
in
wants
September.
To. Yeah, yeah. I'm doing a couple more Museum of Comedies. I don't know whether it's sold out or not. The end of this month, if people are interested. And then I'll probably do more, you know, over the summer and stuff.
Wicked.
Yeah. Yeah, I should plug that really if anybody.
Yeah, go to the Museum of Comedy website and search for Alexi Sale or search for Imaginary Sandwich Bar and you'll see his.
Yeah, so there's two coming up at the end of this month, and then I'll put more in. And it's, you know, I think then you know the shows are not. I think they're much better because you admit, you know, they're work in progress shows, but I think they're still pretty tight, really. And yeah, so I think it's a decent night out in itself, really.
Okay, I have two topical. Current affairs questions for you.
Mm.
One is what's your opinion on the Downing Street party scandal? And the other is, what's your opinion of the slappening? That's what I've called it.
Yes, because you were going to, yeah. Well, to deal with that first, it was really interesting. I mean, again, I'm going to go off on a tangent here in a way. It's really interesting that when Will Smith slapped Chris Rock at the Oscars, I searched inside my soul, because everybody was, you know, bloviating about it, weren't they? I discovered that I passionately didn't care. I mean, I profoundly, violently, I didn't have any kind of opinion at all about any of it. It's like, nah. I don't know whether that's possible in a I don't know if any students of philosophy out there, whether you can passionately, you know, it's a bit like a black hole, isn't it? Which is an absence, really, but is at the same time contains these massive forces of physics. But whether it's possible in a philosophical sense to be passionately uninterested in something. And I was watching, for some reason, Russell Brand's podcast video, whatever they're called, popped up on my the thing down the side when you're looking at stuff on YouTube, which mostly for me is like giant Soviet aircraft, and, you know, guns and stuff, or, you know, stuff about like the Austin Princess Vanden Plas.
You might also like this.
Yeah, it's been offering me Russell Brand, really, and it's an interesting, in a way, said something slightly similar. I mean, in his different way. I mean, and, you know, it's interesting. It's an interesting thing for me to look. I mean, he's got like 5.5 million subscribers and all that stuff. But he said something a bit similar. But also he tried to link it by saying that he was talking about the board, and he was talking about the situationists and this kind of the idea of the spectacle, and just saying how the Oscars are finished and it's kind of decadent spectacle, and you know, it's about and I don't even really feel I mean, he's probably right, but I don't even feel that, really. So yeah, that's my take on that, really. It's also, you know, I feel nothing. There's probably a reluctance. I mean, I don't know whether you know I'm striking a pose here. You know, there's perhaps a reluctance to have an opinion. You know, I just
good for you.
But no, I find nothing. I find
okay.
Yeah,
and Partygate. Anything to say about Partygate? These are both a bit dated now. Both yeah. These things.
Yeah. Not really. Well, it's interesting. The other thing about, I mean, the watching Russell Brand has sort of set running in my mind is this thought, which is also about. Is this the idea of, you know, the comedian as activist, really, and the comedian as commentator, and on and I agree with what Russell Brand says in the interviews, and this is like, not again, I have no set position, and he interviews some really interesting people, and I think his viewpoint, as much as I can decipher it, seems really interesting, but I just wonder, I kind of think that's not, you know, having a, and I do a bit on this show, obviously, but it's like if you take something, the job of the artist is to make art out of something,
yeah,
not to just have an opinion, because that's not good enough, really.
Yeah,
you've got to take that incident of something like Partygate and make something of it, and then it's, when you do, it's complex, and it's, you know, it's kind of a, you know, if you make a really good piece of comedy out of that, you know, it's something really interesting and beautiful. If you just say shit, it's like, yeah, you know,
I suppose
that's not our, if you've got that gift to be a, you know, be a comic, then, you know, make comedy, not, don't say stuff, but yeah. You know, I mean, it's an interesting kind of,
well, I think that's where Russell Brand's journey has led him, hasn't it? He's now more of a pundit than a comedian. You know, I can't.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, and it's, you know, he's obviously, I mean, a million times more successful than we are. But not a million times, but you know, it's sort of somehow. Slightly, I say I agree with everything he says, and I think he's a proposition that seems to be a kind of proposition about anti-nationalism and anti kind of the nation state and a kind of an anarchist kind of position with everything that I agree with, but I find it vaguely depressing.
Well, when you say you agree with everything he says,
well, I don't know about everything. I mean, what I've seen, you know,
yeah,
you may have said something. I'm not offering a blanket.
I think he plays a dangerous game, though, because I know that there's a big crossover in his audience between, you know, lefty liberals, and on also there's like the weird alt-right conspiracy.
Yeah,
nuts,
kind of Joe Rogan stuff, kind of, yeah.
Bit of
yeah.
Joe Rogan-y vibe.
Yeah.
And so although if you're looking at what he says, you know, critically or intelligently, then there's a lot to be taken. But then a lot of people also just they read what they want out of what he says.
And, right. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's just, it's a funny, I mean, he had Yanis Varoufakis on, I think he's very articulate and, he's somebody
is.
I agree with.
He's
completely.
Undoubtedly very intelligent, but I think he's too intelligent for a lot of his audience, which is maybe a bit
Russell Brand or Varoufakis?
Russell Brand.
Maybe, yeah. I notice in the back you often see his cats as well, sort of playing with each other, which is a nice...
it's cute, yeah. He's got this whole...
Yeah, it's kind of cute, yeah. I don't think... We'll see if he wants to come on. I'm sure he won't. I always feel like I remember when I used to do like celebrity interviews for the Radio Times. I think we were always trying to get Russell Brand, but he's never.
That would be a really nice topic to talk to him about as well. Actually, how you the crossover between comic and pundit or commentator.
I think he would not. I don't know why. If he's got any opinion, it's arrogant to think he's got any opinion about.
He'd
me
certainly
whatsoever,
fill an hour for us. He'd be. He'd have a lot to say.
Yeah, but he probably would. I think he would steer well clear of me, I suspect. I might be wrong.
All right, I got I found it a really interesting email that I want to ask you from Neil. As a long-term fan, I've often heard you drop the name Brecht, and because of that, I've read and studied him. So could you talk more about Brecht and what he means to you? And is the spate of actors, comedians, actors and comedians breaking the fourth wall, is that Brechtian or not? and what about the one-man performance of the Threepenny Opera? I love Hotel of the Weeping Woman. All right, that's the whole thing.
Weeping Women Hotel. Get it right.
Well,
Brecht has played an enormous part in my life and as my development as an artist. Set the scene for those who don't know, Bertolt Brecht was a left-wing playwright in pre-war Germany. He survived the war, went to the United States for the duration of the war, came back to, and then lived in East Germany until he died. I think he died at the age of 56, but he also might have died in 1956. I'm not entirely sure. And there's a theater dedicated to his work in Berlin, which is called called the Berliner Ensemble, which was subsidized by the East German government and then survived reunification. I've not prepared anything. Brecht himself, I think, was an amazingly talented character, really, and he pioneered a kind of style of performance which is in many ways unique. It uses, it's always political, it uses elements of cabaret, so people talk directly to the audience. It's also the technique that he pioneered, I think, called alienation, where you are what he talked about was, the normal theatrical mode is catharsis, where you sink into the drama, and you forget that you're watching a drama, and you kind of get your emotions are expunged, or you feel sympathy, and you're made to cry. And in a Brechtian performance, you're always reminded. Yeah. That you're watching the performance, you're always taken out of the moment deliberately. So say this is his most famous works are probably Threepenny Opera, where he worked a lot. He did a lot of musicals. So and he worked with Kurt Weill, a profoundly talented musician and orchestrator. He also did dramas such as. The Good Woman of Szechuan, The Irresistible Rise of Arturo Uy, which is a satire on the rise of Hitler. He was also a phenomenal poet. And some of my favorite poems, I think, are by Brecht. The way that I kind of got into him, I think I was probably my best friend from school, Cliff Cocker, who was also, his parents were also in the Communist Party, and we were in, he was a little bit older than me. We were in the school play together. He, in 1976, started, I think, round about then, started this theatre group called Thripney Theatre. And he did a production, a kind of fringe production of songs and poems of Bertolt Brecht. Mm-hmm. He asked me to be in it. Cliff was a great expert on Brecht, and I listened. I was so taken with all the ideas.
When was this?
Around about 76, I think, 77.
Wow.
And it was the first time that I, you know, performed professionally, as it were.
This was after you'd moved to London?
Oh, yeah. I moved to London in 71. And it gave me the taste for performing, for being in the theatre. And then when that, it was a kind of big, when the theatre group split up, it was me and another Liverpool actor called Bill Monks, and Cliff left, and that's when we said, let's write a comedy show. And from that came, you know, the rest of my career, really. But I've always incorporated Brechtian ideas in my performance. I used to do a bit in my stand-up about, because I looked like Brecht, and I used to do a bit in my stand-up about looking like Bertolt Brecht. I was looking at an old episode of Stuff on YouTube, you see, and there's a bit with Bertolt Brecht advertising hair rollers. written by me, but written by Renaker Marshall. So, yeah, I think he's the great. I mean, I think the Thripney Opera is one of the greatest works of whatever theatre, profound. Also, though, the woman who used to do my publicity when I was doing stuff called Sally Homer, really interesting woman. We talked about doing a. Just like doing a kind of show where I sang and did like a little Brecht show with a trio, and I'd sing the songs, and it's also where I met the musical director of my radio show, Tim. It turned out actually that I can't really sing. I can sing, but I can't sing the same song twice. We spent a lot of time working on the show, and we got other actors and actresses involved. In the course of Sally and their partner, whose name I can't remember, started to researching Brecht and found out, or this was their take on it, that in fact that in a sense Bertolt Brecht was not just an individual, but was a group of. Was him, and then a group of women who he ruthlessly exploited, and in fact did. Yeah, it was a kind of collective, really, that a group of women who Bertolt Brecht himself really exploited rather ruthlessly. He did sometimes give them credit, like Elizabeth Hauptmann, who actually, they said, wrote the main part of Thripney Opera. He did give her a degree of credit for that. He was, I think, Lotte Lenya, I think, who he was he married to, and she was kind of tougher, really, and managed to get, you know, a lot of credit out of him. Was that his wife? I'm not sure. I'm sorry, I haven't researched any of this. I mean, I knew he was a bastard anyway. He was always a bit of a bastard. I know that even though he lived in East Germany, he made sure that all his money, all his royalties were paid into a bank in Switzerland, for instance. Now, I knew he was always a kind of rogue, really. I didn't, but Sally and her partner said, I mean, they never managed to get the show together, really. But, it opened up a whole new... complex kind of area about Brecht himself, really. Nevertheless, however the work was produced, the work itself is magnificent. Mm. The poetry and the musical, the music and the theatre, you know. Caucasian Chalk Circle as well is another masterpiece, I think. And there's a lot of Brechtian influences in Sandwich Bar. The opening song itself is clearly a kind of Brecht parody.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that idea of kind of constantly reminding the audience that they are watching. And I also, I taught at Chelsea Art School, I taught a kind of, I taught Brecht as a kind of general studies option for a couple of years. Yeah. So, yeah, he's profound.
He died in 56 at the age of 58.
At the age of 58, yeah, right.
He had two wives, well, not at the same time, Helene Weigel and Marianne Zoff. But
I think Helene Weigel was pretty, you know, kind of fiercely. Is she the second one?
Yeah.
Yeah, and she was the one, you know, in the kind of fiercely defended the legacy kind of thing, you know, I think.
The second part of the question, like, so the spate of actors and comedians breaking the fourth wall, is that a Brechtian practice?
Can be. It's not necessary. I mean, that idea, you know, he probably didn't invent, kind of. He clearly didn't invent talking directly to the audience.
Well, that was kind of Greek theater did that with the choruses, you know. But I will say, exactly. If you want a modern reference to Brecht, there is a direct one. It's not that modern, but that film Natural Born Killers has a lot of Brechtian elements in it.
Does it? Like I did not know that.
It's Oliver Stone. He purposefully wanted, because the film is so ultra-violent, he wanted to remind the audience as often as possible that they were watching a film and that they wanted to break the suspension of disbelief. So he would do really weird techniques, like have random projections onto the actors.
Right.
And like really unrealistic sequences and editing.
Okay. And he cites Brecht as a...
Yes, I remember him like saying that was an influence.
Well, maybe we should get a Brecht expert on and we can go into this in greater detail. Because certainly...
That was one of my first introductions to drama in high school. I played Arturo Uy in...
Okay.
Terrible, terrible rendition of the play.
I can't. No. Yeah, well, drama schools and, you know, they like them because they got big casts, so everybody gets a part, don't they? It's one of the reasons that Brecht is so popular. I saw a terrible production of Threepenny Opera at the National Theatre a few years ago. Mm. Awful. Depoliticized, really, you know, in the way of our modern age, I think. You know, it's a paean of hate against the ruling class and against the royal, you know, against the idea of royalty and stuff, and all that had been kind of filleted out of it. Really, it was dreadful. But I mean, it was you know, very well done, but entirely empty.
I also had a goldfish. I named it Arturo, and my cat ate it. We have run out of time. We didn't get through many emails, but we did power through a lot of stuff.
Good.
We had Instagram questions we went through. I think that's it for now.
All right. Well, maybe we'll do like an interview. Oh, yes. I think the next thing I'm trying to get together is I've spoken to Nigel Planer and I've spoken to Lisa Mayer about doing a, you know, where we sit and watch an episode of The Young Ones. You say that'll be popular with
you. We've teased that a lot. Yeah, we want to do a YouTube.
I tried to explain it over the phone to Nigel. I'm not sure he was entirely clear about what was going to happen.
So you're going to sit with Nigel and Lisa, fingers crossed, and watch a couple episodes of The Young Ones, and then I will edit that a couple of YouTube videos where it's you and them reacting to, you know, the episode, live commentary almost, you know, almost like a commentary track that you'd get on a DVD, but it'll be edited. And then also we can pause the tape. If you have a good anecdote to tell about something that's just happened, we can pause the film and you guys can have a chat. I think that would be really cool. That will go on the Alexis Sale podcast. Actually, no, it's the YouTube channel is just called Alexis Sale. It's the official Alexis Sale YouTube channel.
All right.
That'll go up on there. Please follow us on Instagram, Alexis L Pod. And the last thing I want to crowbar in, Alexi, is the Patreon, just to remind our listeners.
You say it.
We have a
Patreon. I approve this message.
Thank you, Alexi. It's patreon.com/ Alexis L Podcast. You can find that. And we've just released the first live show we did. We did a live episode of the podcast at the Museum of Comedy in front of an audience. I've put that up on the Patreon, virtually completely unedited. There was a couple bits we just had to get rid of. If you want to see it fully unfiltered, come to the next live one we do. But yeah, you can subscribe for any amount of money on our Patreon, on any tier, and you'll have access to this live show, the next one, which will be coming out in the next couple of weeks, and any more that we do. So please come and join that and support the podcast and the YouTube and everything we do here at Alexi Inc. Any last words, Mr. Sale?
No, just okay, bye.
Okay, bye.
I've got to go.
All right, bye.
There's a man coming round with a thing for me.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to the Alexi Sale podcast, produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Anthony Overton for the sound engineering and to Audio Boom for hosting us. And don't forget, you can support the show by signing up to our Patreon, which is patreon.com/AlexiSale podcast. All right, thank you. Bye.